House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 26, 2015. First item on the agenda is House Bill 2326. Open a work, a public hearing, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2326 amends the conditional discharge statute to fix a problem, declares emergency, and is effective on passage. In State versus Granberry, the Oregon Court of Appeals addressed a situation in which a defendant entered a conditional discharge agreement. Although the defendant did not satisfy the terms of the agreement, the court did not discover this until after the period of probation had lapsed. The Oregon Court of Appeals ruled dismissal was the only appropriate remedy, as the court had lost jurisdiction once the probation period ended. House Bill 2326 fixes this problem and grants the court continued jurisdiction until final disposition occurs. There is no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact statement.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Bovet, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. Counsel has very accurately described the bill. It's very narrow. However, the fiscal placed on it by two of the four state agencies that analyzed it, I think, is in error, in serious error, and I think I need to explain what CDs are just briefly. So in Oregon, we have a conditional discharge statute. It's a wonderful statute. What it allows low-level drug offenders and property offenders whose crimes are driven by drug addiction to do is earn a dismissal of their case. For a couple of decades now, I've been working on this statute, expanding its scope and reach, because it's a good thing to allow people to get clean and earn a dismissal of their case rather than have a felony conviction, for all of the good public policy reasons. So we want to encourage that. The Granberry case threw a little wrench into the works. It really only affects those cases that slip through the cracks of the judicial docketing system. If it affected more than a handful of cases a year, I would be stunned statewide. I'm only aware of two such cases, one out of my county and Granberry itself, and there's probably a handful of other cases. So let me explain real briefly how CDs work. So what happens is, on a conditional discharge, is the offender comes in and pleads guilty to the charge, but the judge does not impose a sentence. Instead, the judge sets sentencing out for just short of a year, places the person on probation. If the person gets evaluated, any treatment they need, comes in just short of a year at sentencing, the judge dismisses the case rather than sentence them. That's mechanically how it works. So at time of sentencing, one of three things happen. The person has done what they need to do, they earn the dismissal. They haven't done what they need to do, the judge gives them more time and extends probation. Or they haven't done anything, the judge is frustrated, and the judge sentences them. That's mechanically what happens. So this bill only affects the narrow, tiny band of cases where some error occurred in the docketing system, where you have a conglomeration of things happening. One, it's not on the docket for sentencing, somehow got removed or put on the wrong date. Two, the person doesn't show up, and then probation lapses. So they haven't done what they needed to do. They haven't earned dismissal, but they get it anyways under Granberry. So this bill fixes that. Two of the four state agencies somehow analyzed it. We have about 2,300 conditional discharges statewide. And they analyzed that about 10% of those cases, probation is extended under the scenario I just described to you. So somehow they felt this would impact those cases, and it wouldn't. So there's significant fiscals that are truly just odd to me. So it's just, this is a narrow technical fix. And the reason why this technical fix is needed is really important, because we don't want to build any disincentives into the system to encourage DAs not to offer conditional discharges. And if we have this Granberry thing hanging out there, the DAs could worry that, hey, the court system might mess up a docket here or there, and the person could get a dismissal when they haven't earned it. So, again, this is a narrow technical fix. I would ask for a revised fiscal. I'm happy to talk with those two state agencies that didn't understand the bill. The other two state agencies did and gave it a minimal fiscal. Because, again, we're talking about a handful of cases statewide each year.
Okay, is there any questions? Okay, thank you. And I would ask that you do that. We'll just close the hearing today because it does seem unusually high.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah,
excuse me. May I ask a question?
Yeah.
Under the ordinary circumstance, it comes time for that person to be reviewed at the 12-month basis. If that person shows up in court in time and hasn't done anything, then the judge would do something. But that's not what this bill is about.
Chair and Representative Greenleaf, no, that's not what this is about.
About it comes to 12 months.
It's not on the docket. The person doesn't show up, and they get the dismissal anyways by operation of law, by operation of a defect in the law.
Okay. So the solution is don't do anything and don't show up and you're okay.
Yes. if the court has also made a docketing error. Because if the court hasn't made a docketing error, what will happen is a warrant will issue for your arrest.
Okay. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2326. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2902.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 2902 eliminates the automatic reporting requirement for juveniles who are adjudicated for felony sex offenses. It requires the court to have a hearing on whether the person should register prior to the end of supervision. The Dash 1 amendment completely replaces the measure. Currently, ORS 181.823 permits a juvenile to seek relief from sex offender registration for acts that would have constituted a felony if committed by an adult. There are time limitations for Class A or B felony offenses. The person must wait 2 years from the end of supervision before seeking relief. For Class C felony offenses, the person must wait 30 days from the end of supervision before seeking relief. The proposed Dash 1 amendment reduces those time limitations and allows the person to file for relief immediately upon completion of supervision. There is no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on this bill.
And I understand, so do we have Dash 1s in there already?
They're already.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mary Kuster, Marcus Wood, and David Lahana, please. Lahana.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, we'll just introduce ourselves. And I'm Marcus Wood, appearing on behalf of the City Club of Portland.
David Lana, also on behalf of City Club.
And Mary Ella Custer, also on City Club.
Okay, and as you testify, when you begin to testify, please state your name again for the record. They record these. Okay, please.
Go ahead.
Hey, my name is Mary Ella Custer, and I am here with my colleagues. Chair Barker and representatives. We're here today to appear on behalf of the City Club of Portland to testify in support of House Bill 2902, which amends the Juvenile Sex Offender Registry Law. And we are aware of the Dash 1 amendment that replaces the bill and will address the policy issue at play in both proposals. So a little background first. The City Club of Portland is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, education, and research-based civic organization dedicated to community service, public affairs, and leadership development. Through our community-based research, advocacy, and the after-hours civic programs, City Club examines issues of importance to the Portland metropolitan area, to the state, and to society as a whole. Our 1,850 members, who represent a cross-section of people in business, government, academia, social services, and other professions, are committed to making a positive difference in our community. Members come from a wide range of ethnic, racial, and religious backgrounds, and membership is open to everyone of high school age or older. So that's a little background about City Club, who we represent. In March of 2014, the City Club assembled a broadly representative and diverse group of members to address the current Oregon laws regarding the registration of juvenile sex offenders. We met many times over a period of 7 months. We studied the growing body of research on juvenile offenders, as well as all the literature that's coming out now and the research into adolescent brain development. We interviewed 17 witnesses who represented every part of the juvenile justice system, as well as treatment providers, legislators, advocates for both youth offenders, as well as victim rights. We engaged in passionate, in fact, often heated, I may say, debates, which we believe enriched our conclusions and our recommendations. Our resulting report contains a series of recommendations that were then put to City Club member for vote. By a 96% affirmative vote, the recommendations were approved. We appear here today briefly highlight our findings and recommendations as your committee considers what we to believe is an important reform to our juvenile sex offender registry law. You have a copy, we've submitted a copy of the report, and you all have those. As a society, we have chosen to treat sex offenders differently from other type of offenders in an effort to protect the victims and the vulnerable. No other crime carries the possibility of lifetime registration with law enforcement. 20 years ago, when Congress passed the first national offender legislation, our country was just beginning to talk about sexual assault and abuse, a very difficult conversation which continues today. Our committee work benefited from and was informed by the past two decades of extensive research on sex crimes and offenders, specifically sex offenders who offended as juveniles. All of us on the committee, and that was unanimously, if there was any unanimity on the committee, it was the fact that we agreed that Oregon's registration of young sex offenders adjudicated in juvenile court is deeply flawed. Perhaps the greatest flaw, number one, is that the law currently subjects all juvenile offenders to lifetime registration without regard to individual risk assessments. In fact, Oregon is one of only six states that automatically registers all juvenile offenders for life at the time they are adjudicated. And the second big flaw is that the law requires that offenders register at the time of initial adjudication rather than after the results of extensive supervision and treatment are known, but at the time they are adjudicated. We believe the current process harms both juvenile offenders and the public. And Marcus will talk about our findings and recommendations.
Thank you.
I'm Marcus Wood, speaking on behalf of the City Club of Portland, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to summarize a few findings that we think are relevant to this House bill, and also two recommendations that we hope you'll consider very carefully. First, let me review a few findings. The first and a very important finding I want to be clear about is that we all agreed that sex abuse and assault are serious crimes and that those crimes can carry a lifetime impact on the victim. We agreed that sex offenders should be held accountable for their offenses. Steps should be taken to reduce the risk of reoffense, and although our charge focused on offenders, victims were never far from our thoughts on this. We also recognized, however, that offenses committed by a juvenile do not necessarily indicate a lifetime propensity for victimizing others. Brain development research demonstrates that impulse control, reasoning, and ability to exercise judgment are developing during adolescence. They're not the same in a 13-year-old as in a 19-year-old. And treatments during the juvenile period can and do effectively change behavior. These facts explain why the overwhelming majority of supervised and treated juvenile sex offenders will, in fact, never be arrested for another sex crime. We also found that, however, that sex offender registration often results in juvenile offenders facing barriers to education, housing, and employment, as well as to community institutions that help them integrate back into the community. The purpose of registration is, in fact, to protect public safety, as stated in the legislation. It's not to impose a further punishment on people who have already been supervised, perhaps incarcerated, and treated. Indeed, our committee heard convincing testimony that the current policy of registering all juveniles adjudicated of sex crimes at the time of adjudication may in fact work against public safety by alienating rather than rehabilitating youth who otherwise are fully capable of being rehabilitated. Under current law, a juvenile adjudicated of a felony sex crime is required to register at the time of initial adjudication regardless of what the judge handling the case thinks. However, We're going to learn a lot more during the multi-year period that this juvenile is subject to extensive supervision and treatment. We're going to learn a lot more about what their risk assessment is. Moreover, during the treatment and supervision period, the whereabouts of the juvenile offender are well known and his or her activities are strictly controlled so that registration during the supervisory period does not advance public safety. And I want to emphasize this. Oregon spends a lot of money on every sex offender and treatment and supervision. It's much more extensive than adult parole. The juvenile is specified where the juvenile may live, who they may associate with, what extracurricular activities they may participate in. If they're in a school, the principal knows of the fact. When they have to be home is specified. They have to take lie detector tests. The fact is they are heavily supervised, and there's not really anything added by registering them as sex offenders and making this a public problem while we're trying to rehabilitate them. We also asked the police, the Portland, we talked to the heads of both sex crimes units, and asked if they could think of a time in which the registration, in fact, helped them solve a crime with juveniles. And in both cases, they thought a while and said, we cannot think of a single instance. So we don't think that putting the juveniles on during the supervisory period is helping solve crimes. Final finding I want to emphasize is that under current Oregon law, juvenile offenders are eligible to obtain relief from registration after a period of time, and we note that most juveniles who actually seek relief get relief. However, what we heard uniformly from judges, prosecutors, and treatment providers is that relatively few of the almost 3,000 people registered solely for juvenile offenses have actually sought relief. We believe the reasons are twofold. One of them is lack of notice, and the second is the complexity of the legal system and the financial cost impose significant barriers, particularly to poorly informed or just to poor offenders. And I should note that there's a catch-22. If you're on the register, you're not likely to have a decent job, and you're likely to be poor. Thus, because relatively few registered offenders apply for relief, I think we can say the people currently registered for juvenile offenses may, in fact, be more distinguished by their lack of financial resources than by any threat they pose to the public. This result seems inconsistent with the purpose of existing laws, which is to give rehabilitated persons, juvenile offenders, the right and ability to get off the registration. As a result of our findings, I'd like to emphasize two recommendations that we hope you'll consider very carefully. These recommendations basically call for an end to what is now a blanket registration as applied to all juveniles adjudicated for felony sex offenses and would make relief from registration simpler and less costly for those who have, in fact, been rehabilitated. Our first recommendation was reflected in the initial House Bill 2902, but we think, unfortunately, has been removed from in the Dash 1 amendment. We believe that Oregon law should be amended to provide that registration be at the discretion of the juvenile court and the registration decision be made near the end of the juvenile supervision and treatment process, not at the beginning. At this point, you really have the information to determine and make a risk assessment. The juvenile offender should have the right of counsel during the registration hearing, and if financially eligible, should have counsel appointed at state expense, as occurs for all other aspects of their adjudication. Our second recommendation relates to those currently on the registry for solely juvenile sex crimes to give them the tools that are necessary to seek the relief the registration already that is already contemplated under current Oregon law. As I mentioned above, one of our findings is that there are many juvenile offenders who are eligible for removal under current law but are not aware of their eligibility, and if they were aware, don't have the financial resources to actually apply. We believe that House Bill 2902 should be amended with respect to those already on the registry solely for sex crimes committed as a juvenile, I note, to provide notice of the rights of the registrant to seek relief from registration. And I note that that can quite easily be done because the state police have an up-to-date record of the addresses of all such offenders, and We are talking about simply providing the plain English notice at the time they become eligible, so they know they're eligible. And secondly, to provide the registrant seeking such relief, if financially eligible, with counsel appointed at state expense. Again, so that we can get a registry that reflects risk to the public and not the wealth of the individual former offender. Though we hope you'll consider these two recommendations. We've provided copies of the report. We thank you for giving us a chance to speak, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank the City Club for doing this report. I was one of the folks who was interviewed for it, and you did a really thorough job of bringing everyone involved in this issue to the table and collecting information. And if you haven't, committee members, read the report, it's a great primer on this area of law and the emerging issues in science and in law around juvenile brain development and how juvenile sex offenders are very different than adult sex offenders. And so I just want to thank you for all of your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Marcus, just a quick scenario. So from the way I'm reading the -1 amendments that you have, if you have a 16-year-old boy, 16-year-old juvenile who gets convicted of, let's say, sex abuse first degree, so he ends up going into OIA under DOC for 75 months. He comes out. You see that he can petition at that point, the way I read this, and not become a sex offender registrant.
As I understand -1 gives the right of the offender to petition to get off. It keeps the current provisions that say that you are automatically placed on the registry at the time of adjudication, which means if they're 16 or if they're 13 or 12 and we're trying to rehabilitate them, they are a registered sex offender, and that often is quite publicly becomes publicly known, that is our concern. We believe the decision should be made, and it's a question of when. We don't think they should be automatically put on, and we recognize that the time you know something is, or the time you know the most, is near the end of supervision.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
But the -1 isn't your amendment, is it?
No. We don't know whose it is.
Substitutes for your...
We have not put a bill in at all. We are simply trying to indicate the results of our own study and recommendations that we hope you'll consider in whatever the final bill is. We are not sponsoring any bill here.
And you don't support either the main bill or the -1, is that right?
Well, we support the principle of what they're trying to accomplish, but we are not, we don't have ownership of either one of those bills. Mm-hmm.
But we are speaking in favor of 2902.
In the sense that it will
broadly
amend and reform the current law. But we're not testifying on the provisions of any specific bill.
May I follow?
Yes.
Well, does the main bill, not the -1s, does that meet the objectives of the report that, in your mind, does that meet the objectives of the report, or is it moving in the direction?
The main bill meets our first concern about the timing, in the sense that it defers it lets a court make the decision and defers that decision to the time at the end of supervision, and provides counsel if the party is indigent. And we think those provisions are all very favorable ones. No bill does anything with respect to the people who are already on the list. Now, I realize that has a financial impact, which may cause it to get separated as a consideration. But we do think that it's time to think about cleaning the list for people who are really rehabilitated, and no bill addresses that, as I said.
And Chair and representatives, 2902 does, I don't want to use the wrong terminology, but it does give the state a touch of responsibility to notify eligible offenders of the right to seek relief. Currently, all of that is on the youth offender. They have to remember what they heard when they were 16 and were adjudicated and sent off for treatment.
Or 11.
Or 11 or 10 or whatever, but it... A little bit of help there.
Thank you. Anything further? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Rubino, Mark McKechnie, and Carol Woodcock. Carlotta Woodcock. In any order, please remember to identify yourself for the record.
We'll do that. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is David Rubino. I'm an attorney at Tonkin Torp, and I am here speaking in support of 2902. I am here in my personal capacity as well as a representative of what we call the Cliff Project, Changing Lives Forever, which is a pro bono project that's run out of our office to assist eligible youth to seek the relief of getting off of the sex registry. My first experience with having to deal with the sex registry was actually when I decided to take cases on behalf of the Cliff Project. I think I'm not going to repeat a lot of the facts that I heard before. They were eloquently stated by the panel that came before me. My experience, though, is that a lot of the people that are caught in the web, especially the juveniles that we deal with, are not the typical sort of sex abusers or child molesters that the public, I think, wants on the registry. Very often, they're young, confused children who themselves have potentially been victims of abuse. They come from broken homes in very difficult circumstances very often, and can be turned around by getting an opportunity to have proper treatment and time with the right professionals. After that, they typically want to move on and live their lives as adults and be as productive as anybody else in this room. The current scheme, in my view, is, I'm not going to varnish it, I think it's grotesquely unfair. It essentially allows no judicial discretion. As soon as a youth, regardless of age, is adjudicated, they're required to register for life. The judge has no option. Second, the lifetime registration is a huge impediment to them moving forward as adults. And I'll give some examples of that shortly. The research that I've been providing and have done indicates that the recidivism rate is extremely low. And typically it's front-loaded, which means if these kids are going to reoffend, they're going to do it very early. But once they go through treatment, the likelihood of them reoffending is extremely low. Finally, as was said before, requiring them to file a petition is an enormous burden. Financially, it's a burden. And in addition, it's hard for them to get the records. A lot of these kids have been adjudicated. They've gone through the system. They have been out, as my examples will indicate, 10, 15 years. Most places don't keep records that long. So when they go back and try and get the records they need to meet the burden of proof that the law requires them to meet, a lot of times they're coming up empty. Or they have a much, much harder time because they come at the process so late. So some examples of people that we have worked with through the Cliff program. One individual is 32 years old. He was adjudicated as a 13-year-old. He's currently married, has several children, and has a very good job in a local financial institution. He is not allowed under the current law to coach his children's youth soccer games. He may not attend or take his children to the local YMCA. He may not attend school functions. And he's in constant fear of his job being in jeopardy if his status as a registrant ever comes out. Another individual was adjudicated as a 12-year-old. He finally got relief from the registry at the age of 32. He never reoffended. He went through treatment. He currently has a very good job with a very well-known company in the area. He, too, was at risk of losing his job if his registrant status ever came out for an act he committed as a 12-year-old and never committed again. The final example I have is a gentleman who was adjudicated at the age of 14. He himself was a victim of child abuse, and he came from a broken home. He was in and out of foster care, and at one time was found to have violated the requirement to register because he was homeless. And one of the reasons he was homeless is because he couldn't even get in to some of the public shelters because he was a registrant. This system needs to change. That is unfair to the individuals who otherwise committed an act as a youth, go through treatment, rehabilitate, try to get their lives back in order. This last individual had a job application rejected by Federal Express for the graveyard shift of doing package sorting because he was a registrant. That individual poses no risk to the public, nor do any of the other examples I've provided. In short, I'll conclude, this system is broken. This system needs to be fixed. 2902 is a great start. It may not be the end, but it would be a very, very good start. I'm happy to take any questions anybody has.
Would it be helpful if at the end of the treatment and everything, if the judge is required to make a decision then on registration?
It would help an awful lot, because then you don't have the people going on the sex registry at all. Okay, so if you let them go through the treatment process and have a determination made then, they don't have that black mark. So then they don't have to check the box when they're looking for housing, or have to check the box when they're looking for a job. They can get on with their lives, and they work hard to get through treatment. Treatment is no joke.
So the testimony that if I understood it correctly earlier, so when you're adjudicated, they then say you have to register, and then you go through the treatment things.
That's right.
And then at the end of that time, they could lift the registration. I understand it would be simpler if they never had it to begin with. But
under the current program, if you're adjudicated at the age of 12, you have to start registering at the age of 12. And every time you move, you have to register again. We've had one client in our program who was caught or found to have violated the notification because she changed dorm rooms in college.
And how long does it? If you maybe there isn't, I don't know, I'm asking this because I don't know the answer. Sure. How long does the treatment take normally, or is there a huge difference in the amount of treatment, people are treated?
Others can speak to this better than I can, but typically in my experience, the treatment goes on for at least 3 years. It's very intensive. It's typically on the order of, you know, weeks, days of every week for each of the years you're in. It is very, very intensive treatment that these kids go through.
Okay, thank you. Any other further questions?
I have some questions. The 12-year-old that you were describing, can you advise this committee what crimes that individual committed, and if it was multiple times or just a single time?
No, he was adjudicated one time. I don't believe it's appropriate for me to get into what the actual act was, because it was by a youth. I wouldn't be able to do that under other circumstances, but I will say that it did not involve anything more than touching.
Did it? Okay, follow up. Please. Did it meet what, if done by an adult, would be a Measure 11 crime?
At the time he was adjudicated, it met this. I mean, this adjudication occurred back in 1998, I believe. So it met whatever the required standard was at the time. Yes.
One more question.
Please.
The student that you just described that was in the dorm room for failing to report for her change of address, was she charged with that?
My understanding is she was charged with a failure to register, yes, for failing to notify the appropriate authorities of a change of address. I was not.
That's your understanding. You don't know that for a fact.
That is from speaking to one of the lawyers in my office who handled the case.
That's fine.
My name is Carlotta, committee members and honorable chair. My name is Carlotta Wolcock. I live in the Beaverton Hillsboro area, and I work in Hillsboro. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Voices, which is a grassroots collection of family members, friends, and concerned individuals who include registered sex offenders and others entangled in the justice system that are attempting to piece their lives together before, after, and during prison sentencing. I'm here to speak in favor of this bill, as we see it as a progressive step forward that will assist those who wish to put their lives behind them or put their past behind them to move in a productive life in society. First of all, I want to thank this committee and the legislators who have been attempting time after time in the past to get something like this legislation through. It goes without saying that the subject of sex offenders is a quintessential political hot potato, and any politician or public official who's perceived as being soft on crime in general and crimes that fit within the statutory jurisdiction of sex offenses is going to face burned fingers from holding that hot potato. So we at Oregon Voices wish to thank you for your diligence and your persistence and effort. That said, we have a couple of suggestions for strengthening the impact of this legislation for your consideration as it moves forward. The process of accusation, adjudication, serving time, and post-prison life holds many type of opportunities for truth to come forward and is often an emotionally charged, subjectively interpreted process in any crime, but especially in the court of public opinion for cases involving sexual offenses. Rules of evidence adherence, misconduct by police, investigators, defense and prosecuting attorneys, judges, as well as supportive counselors and treatment providers, are frequent subjects of pre- and post-conviction court hearings, as individuals who are struggling to put their lives into a track of normalcy work to clear away barricades that hold them back from rights we assume in our nation. The question that jumps out to me and others in our group is, who writes and when do they write the recommendation to the juvenile courts to effectively try this juvenile offender or place them on or off the registry? Post-release is perhaps one of the most critical points not defined in this bill. Is the registry participation decided at the time of sentencing? If the individual is to be defended by an attorney at the time of the hearing in this bill, will it be the same attorney as previous, or the registration recommendation accountable to the same district attorney? Is it decided by the gravity of the crime and conviction? What about the individuals who are convicted in other states on criteria not consistent with Oregon statutes? Or is it decided while, after years of maturing through the juvenile justice system, the individual manages to demonstrate behavior inconsistent with their teenage past, and it would appear to be one of responsible citizenry? Who makes that observation, and does the now adult individual have any role or say in it? I would suggest here that in preparing this law, that means which explicitly guarantee objectivity, such as a third-party evaluation of all materials affecting the decision to recommend the registry, or possibly some other form of fresh eyes on the situation, be inserted legislatively. This can be essential to avoid the connection of pre- and post-conviction behaviors that individuals, as they mature, can decide to cast aside. In my work with Oregon Voices, I field calls from individuals regularly who were convicted as a crime as a youth, and 20 years later are still attempting to hold a job that will allow them minimal survival means. College and high school degrees obtained in prison while in juvenile facilities are very helpful in that process, but employers who look at a person's current practice, not the mistakes that may or may not have been made in the past, and are few and far between. Post-conviction release process requiring counseling and therapy is premised on the concept that these individuals can learn to break with the behaviors that led them to their crime. Too often, 20 years down the road, those people are broken, antisocial, unable to even access limited community services that might help them due to their registry status. This law has the potential to take the redemption process one step further by allowing those youth, full of whatever it was that got them convicted in the first place, to step beyond that. When those with whom they walk the reparations part of this journey give them that chance and have clearly defined priorities and criteria, statistically we've seen a reduced level of recidivism. Please be the ones who pave that path that juvenile offenders walk with solid moral ground so that they need not wallow in the shifting muck of inconsistency that they were unable to sort in the past. Thank you.
Any questions at all? I would just say one thing. We've talked in the past about out of state, and as you are talking about all the problems with being registered, if Oregon was to say you can come here and you'll be off the registration, that would not work because if I was registered somewhere else, and if I was registered in Oregon and they said if you moved to Idaho, you're off the hook, you'd have to move to Idaho. I mean, you'd move to Idaho to avoid that. So, and without being able to really clear what had happened some other state, it would be very difficult to go there. I'm hearing some very interesting concepts for people convicted in Oregon today, and I appreciate that. So,
thank you.
Yeah, Mark.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. Yeah, good to see you again since yesterday. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2902 And I thought I should lead off with a few kind of cleanup items based on questions asked earlier. To Representative Olson's question earlier about a 16-year-old, I want to make it very clear that that this bill and any amendments to it would apply to juveniles only, meaning that anyone who was waived automatically under Measure 11 or waived by the juvenile court to adult court would not be affected by this bill. It only applies to youth who are adjudicated in the juvenile court system. So a 16-year-old who's charged with sex abuse one is automatically waived to the adult court. In my experience, they virtually never get waived back. The other thing I wanted to mention is that relief from registration or lack of registration is not expungement. These offenses are still non-expungible offenses. So it's not like the record goes away and no one can find out about this history. And in fact, most people now, for any kind of sensitive job, especially if you work with children or any other vulnerable people, is going to ask you about both an adult criminal and a juvenile delinquency history and would have the opportunity to uncover that information even without the registry. The other thing that I think can be a concern is that the lack of registration or getting relief from registration is not a free pass. It doesn't accept anyone from what they may do in the future, and someone who commits a new offense will be subject to the laws at that point, whether they're adjudicated in the juvenile system again or convicted as an adult. And so there's no get out of jail free card, so to speak, by not merely not being registered. I also don't want to cover too much of what's already been said, but I have some materials that were posted to OLIS that I want to point your attention to. And part of the reason why you may see a chart like this, the Caldwell study out of Wisconsin, part of the reason why the research has shown conclusively that registration doesn't prevent future offenses and further public safety generally is that two things. The reoffense rates, as you've heard, of juveniles are very low, and it tends to be the broadest range I've seen in the literature is 1% recidivism to 12 at the highest point. But most of the studies and most of our local data cluster around the 4 to 8% range. And in fact, what this study found, looking at youth who are adjudicated of a sex offense versus those who are adjudicated of some other type of offense and were incarcerated because it was a serious enough offense, the chances that anyone from either group was likely to commit a sex offense in the future was statistically the same. It was 7% for one and 6% for the other, statistically not a significant difference. But only one of those groups would have been required to register. The other reason why research has found no public safety benefit or deterrence for future offenses is the fact that the vast majority of new offenses are committed by someone with no prior adjudication or conviction. There was a 20-year study in an article described in an article called The Watched Pot in New York State that looked at all arrests over a 20-year period, including the decade prior to New York's registry law and the decade following New York's registry law, and found that 96% of the people arrested overall for a sex offense had never been convicted of a previous one. So the registry falsely points attention at people who are unlikely to offend and also has the potential effect of distracting our attention from other people who might offend because they're not on the registry. I think it really gives the public, frankly, a false sense of security. Even if they were to go to the registry and try to look people up, it would be very misleading to have that information. The other information in OLIS I wanted to point you to is this chart that our office has put together to try to compare Oregon to some other states and give you a better sense of how out of line our law is with other states. About 10% of states, 10 20% of states, 10 other states, have no registry requirement for juveniles. Now, that may sound like it puts Oregon sort of in the norm, but when you look at the specific requirements of other states' registries, you find that Oregon is sort of at the extreme end in applying automatic lifetime registration. I compared some other states that would be of interest and many that have similar population sizes, and none of them compare to Oregon's requirements. We have the dubious distinction of having the highest number of registered sex offenders per capita in the entire country. And as for juveniles, we require five times as many per capita to register in Oregon as they do in the state of Texas. Not a state that's has a reputation for being soft on crime, I might add. And you'll see that ours is the only one with automatic registration for juveniles. Many states provide the kind of judicial discretion that 2902 provides. Many only require registration for juveniles who are waived to adult court. Many of them exclude juveniles from any kind of public registry or allow the judge to exclude individuals from the public registry, which Oregon also doesn't give judges a say. And many of the other states where it's relevant have a time limit where the person will be automatically removed from the registry. In many states, 10 years is the norm, but other states have an age-based relief that can be as young as 18 or 21. So that's part of the reason why our office for the last 5 years has been working on this issue, because we see how damaging Oregon's approach is to the kinds of youth that we serve who are adjudicated of these offenses and the lifelong impact it has on them, which has been described, the being unable to get housing, go to school, get jobs, and participate in normal family activities like watching your own child's soccer game, for example. I'll touch briefly on the Dash 1 amendment and the effect of that. Frankly, I would hate to see you adopt the Dash 1 amendment, to put it bluntly, because it would, first and foremost, it would remove a much better approach in the underlying bill. If adopted alone, it would have very little effect, we believe, on helping individuals get off the registry, because it merely eliminates a two-year waiting period for youth with A or B felony adjudications. And the fact that it still delays the opportunity to have to file a petition for relief post court jurisdiction means that none of those youth, I believe, would have access to a public defender, which means they would either need to be able to hire an attorney or find one of the few volunteer attorneys who are doing these kinds of cases that probably have the capacity to represent about 1% of the people who need that kind of legal help currently. So with that, I'll end, and glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I don't know if there's any questions, but maybe kind of reminding ourselves back to 2011 when you and I co-chaired and the mandatory sex offender registration to be go online was a proposal that we had, which we killed, even though it passed unanimously in the Senate. That was one of the best things we ever did into a Senate bill since I've been in the building for 15 years, in my opinion. But the Senate didn't hear everything we heard in testimony. Remember that, Mr. Chair? We made some great steps. We had a work group put together at that time. I think there's only two people on the committee, or three, that were here at the time, maybe three or four. I don't think you were here yet. You were here, but you weren't on the committee. And, you know, we had parole and probation, OSP, DA, defense bar, and there were some others that worked for nearly 2 years. Pretty well came to a consensus of what we needed to do, an assessment process, static 99, but doesn't work well for juveniles. If you really want to get back to my favorite word, remember justice? We need to look at this real hard. I would suggest, I don't know how many more people you're going to have testify, but really, if you had Mark Gale Myers take a look at this bill just a little bit and say, is there a few changes we need to make, or is it okay? I think we need to move forward with the basis of the original bill. That would do more for our juveniles. We're just down in public safety, ways and means, parole and probation. I think you chaired it that day, the difficulty they're having to do an assessment on all these people now. If we don't put them on there to start with, you don't have to do an assessment later, as long as they've had the programs and services to make sure that they're not going to be a risk for the rest of the public later on. But if you think about a young man or woman, remember the motion I was going to make, Mr. Chair? You said if I said that, you'd gavel me down? Uh-huh. Everybody stand up. Whoever ever touched a girl's breast is in high school. He says if I... yeah, well, he says I'll gavel you down if you make that motion.
That's not what we're talking about here. But,
but it is yeah. In the fact that young men, women do things one time inadvertently, exploratory type thing as young people. I don't think they're really criminals that pose a risk.
Not crimes, yeah. even when they do that. So, thank you. And so, again, even with this bill, it would not affect anybody waived into Measure 11.
Chair Barker, correct.
Okay, thank you. Any further thing? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Great cases to bring forward. Gail Meyer, Debbie Martin.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Hearkening back to Representative Krieger's comments, for some of us, it's been a very long conversation discussing the sex offender registry. And it was a noble moment in 2011 when it was this committee that hijacked a bill and said, you know, we have to take a second look at what we're doing with this registry. Because what this committee heard in 2011 was this wave of families coming up and saying, do you have any appreciation of what it will mean if the registry information were to become in its entirety publicly known? That generated, as Representative Krieger was discussing, a quite extensive work group that then resulted in legislation in 2013 that addressed only the adult registry. That was only for adults who had been adjudicated as adults. We knew we were leaving the juveniles alone. And that meant we were leaving the juveniles with the default position of you get adjudicated of a sex crime, it's the default position in Oregon is you have to register for life. We knew we were leaving the juveniles out of the conversation. So to a large extent, 2902 is unfinished business from that discussion because we've left them, you know, with the more draconian version of what our laws had been. It's been underscored already. I'll just say it a third time. This is not affected by Measure 11 conduct. So if you do have a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old, committing a ballot Measure 11 crime, this bill does not deal with them. And that includes Sex Abuse 1, which is a touching for, you know, sexual gratification or arousal. So what is left to be addressed by this bill then are the 14-year-olds and younger who are adjudicated for sex offense.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but also would do a 17-year-old that isn't.
Correct. Exactly, Chair Barker. You're correct. It's someone 17, 16, 15-year-old who's committed a non-ballot Measure 11 sex offense. But given the fact that Sex Abuse 1 is committed by a touching, there's not a lot.
Usually those are plead down from a rape one. Mm. I mean,
Yeah, Chair Barker, I just want to say that Measure 11 scoops up, though, into its reach, conduct as minimal as touchings. And that's what just what I want to say. Okay, so and what this harkens to me is the question of really the analysis of what's the purpose of the registry to begin with? Why are we asking these people to register at all? And the registry started with the supposition that it was designed to help law enforcement prevent future crimes. Well, on the theory that if they knew where an offender was living and someone alleged they had been offended against, but they didn't know whom it was, that law enforcement would know who the offenders were in that area. But most people are offended by somebody that they know. And so when the call is made to law enforcement, they're able to identify who their offender is. So you don't need to access the registry. So the registry is designed for people who were convicted in Connecticut, got convicted, went to Connecticut or Kentucky, got convicted, and now they're ending up in Oregon. And the registry was designed to make sure that local law enforcement knew who was living in what jurisdiction, who had had sex offenses, so that they'd know. That is so different from a youth, a 14-year-old who's under the supervision of the juvenile department, who is being supervised, who is in treatment, who is in school. People know where they live. They know where this kid is. So it's not quite the legitimacy for the registry is just very, very different for a child who is on supervision. So what we like about 2902, it defers the decision until the jurisdictional limits of the juvenile court are coming to an end, and it has that hearing then at that right time, which was really the time to ask. Now that this person is launching, so to speak, into unsupervised land, do we need to know? Or have they proven to us that really this is someone who's not a danger to society? So we very much appreciate the bill, and we would love to see it move forward.
And I would just, you said, why are we asking? We're not, we're not asking, we're telling. So to register. I mean, the way you said it was kinder than.
Oh, thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Debbie Martin. I'm a parole and probation supervisor with the Oregon Youth Authority in Lane County. I've worked with juvenile sex offense specific issues for the past 15 years in a few different capacities, and I currently serve as the president of the Oregon Adolescent Sex Offending Treatment Network. I was asked by Youth Rights and Justice to provide some information about sex offense registration in juveniles. Over the past several years, I've monitored research in the area of juvenile sex offense registration policies. While the research is sparse, there is none that supports sex offense registration for juveniles that it improves community safety. The research also indicates there is no general deterrence impact or the ability to avert potential first-time offenders with sex offense registration policies. Some of the concerns noted in the research indicate that sex offense registration may serve to socially isolate youth by increasing difficulty in finding employment, decreasing their involvement in education or vocational programs, and increasing a fear of bullying or harassment if people find out about their sex offense registration status. Social isolation, lower education and vocational success, and lower employment rates actually serve to increase a youth's risk for recidivism. I think we also need to consider labeling theory when we look at this, which is the idea that if you attach a label to somebody, especially an adolescent who is developing their identity at that period of time, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, meaning that they will take actions to make that label true. I want to just end with some statements from the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, which is ATSA. And it's really the preeminent national and international organization in this field. The public policy paper on adolescents with sexually abusive behavior from 2012 indicates the following about sex offense registration. Such practices are inconsistent with community safety and promotion of pro-social development, and in fact may actually elevate a youth's risk by increasing known risk factors for sexual and non-sexual offending, such as social isolation. Research findings indicate rehabilitative efforts with most youth are effective, and that therapeutic interventions rather than social control strategies are likely to not only be more successful but cost-effective as well. It goes on to say, effective public policy and practice for adolescents who have engaged in sexually abusive behavior involves a strong rehabilitative focus. At times, juvenile justice sanctions may be warranted. Support of a rehabilitative approach is consistent with the more general juvenile justice philosophies in most countries, including the United States and Canada, and recognizes adolescence as a time of hope and opportunity for positive outcomes. I thank you for the opportunity to present this information, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Howes?
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Howes. I'm the first assistant to District Attorney Rod Underhill in Multnomah County. I'm here on behalf of District Attorney Rod Underhill and the Oregon District Attorneys Association to voice our opposition to HB 2902 as it's currently written. And I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify in front of you today. I want to let you know that I was here many times on House Bill 2549, which was passed in 2013. I continue to work on that. I work on the work group that's working to implement the rules that will guide that bill and that law as it goes forward. I want to let you know that in Multnomah County, there are currently, as the practice is, three different ways that a youth that is has committed a felony sex offense can either avoid being placed on the registry or can obtain relief from being on the registry. In about 25% of the cases that come through our juvenile department, they're dealt with by way of an alternative disposition, which, and I know you just heard earlier about conditional discharge, it's similar to that, in which the case is one in which the court will allow the youth to enter an admission but will not enter that admission into the record. Instead, the court will place the youth on something similar to probation. It can't actually be probation because the admission has not been entered. But the conditions are the same. Individual therapy, group therapy, family therapy, plethysmographs, polygraphs, the things that are in place in order to treat the youth so that chances of reoffending decrease. If the youth successfully completes that program within 2 to 3 years usually, then that petition is going to be dismissed and there will never be a need to register. If the youth is unsuccessful, then of course the admission will be entered into the record and that will trigger the requirement to register. Under a 2012 Court of Appeals case, State versus CEB, it's possible for the youth to move to dismiss the petition at any time, and the court can grant it in the interest of justice. This is a very instructive case, and I would encourage those interested to read it. And I think it should be noted that in that case where the petition was dismissed, and this is similar to the testimony we heard earlier. This was a nearly 25-year-old man when he applied to have his petition dismissed for conduct that he had engaged in when he was 12 and 13 years old. And the court granted that, the state appealed, and the granting of the dismissal of that petition was upheld. That wasn't a touching case. That was a 12 and 13-year-old boy who had committed multiple acts of rape and sodomy upon his sister. So it was a very serious case. The court said this petition can be dismissed. The juvenile court still has jurisdiction. Third, of course, and you know this because it's the current status of the law, if the youth has been on supervision has ended, 2 years after that, the youth can petition for the relief from registration. My organizations have concerns with House Bill 2902 as it's written, and I want to lay out a couple of those for you. First off, and I think most of the members of the committee know this, there are no true actuarial risk assessment tools for juvenile. We heard this many times during the testimony on House Bill 2549 2 years ago. There are no accurate risk assessment tools for juveniles. There's two that are OK, the J Soap, and I'm not going to go into the acronyms, and the Eraser, but the Center for the Management of Juvenile Sex Offenders in the Community. It's a project of the Office of Justice Programs of the U.S. Department of Justice, has said and repeatedly these are not true actuarial risk assessment tools. Currently, under ORS 181823 sub 6, if there's a motion for relief from registration, the prosecutor has the option of requesting an updated psychosexual evaluation of the youth. That's going to be paid for at state expense, not the youth expense, but it gives the state and the court an opportunity to check in to say, how is this youth doing? Is this a good risk or not? This bill completely shifts the burden as it currently exists in the ORS from the youth requesting relief from registration to the state. It also excludes the juvenile department and the OYA from being parties to the hearing. Without the juvenile department or the OYA from being parties to the hearing, they're not going to be able to offer testimony that is helpful to the judge in making the decision to allow relief from registration or to not impose registration requirement at all. The law as it currently stands lists a litany of considerations that the court must consider when determining whether or not to relieve the youth from the duty to register. And these are important, and they're not in House Bill 2902. The extent of the physical and emotional injury to the victim, whether force was used, whether the act was premeditated, whether the person took advantage of a position of trust, the age of the victim at the time of the offense, the age difference between the victim and the offender, other acts that would, if committed as an adult, would be a crime, a statement by the victim or the victim's parents. This HB 2902 allows for the state to call the victim as a witness. Now, that's a whole separate issue, but I would submit to this committee that recalling a victim of a sex crime for what would amount to be a second or third time at a hearing to determine whether or not relief from registration is appropriate is tantamount to re-victimizing that child again. It also, in the current law, considers the acceptance of responsibility, the treatment history, and there's many more. I just pulled out the highlights. House Bill 2902 decreases the quantum of evidence necessary to make this decision. Currently, it's fairly high. The youth has to show by clear and convincing evidence that he or she is rehabilitated, that he or she no longer presents a danger to the community. This changes that to a preponderance of the evidence. And critically, the language in House Bill 2902 states that the court will not impose the duty to register if the court finds by a preponderance of the evidence that reporting is necessary for the safety of the public and the prevention of future sex offenses by the person. I would submit to this committee that that's a nearly impossible standard to meet, especially given that there are no risk assessment tools that are normed and accurate to make this kind of assessment. Proof, if possible at all, may require something like an affirmative admission by the youth himself. I plan to commit a sex offense in the future. I don't know how else you'd get there given this language. In closing, this bill seems to me and my organizations to be designed to do one thing, eliminate the requirement for youths to have to register. I understand and I certainly think that the testimony we've heard today has been compelling. It's been well presented, and I think it's a testament to the great local bar and local people that we have working in the state that come up with these arguments. My position here today is that this bill, 2902 as written, causes the pendulum to swing so wildly the other direction that it leaves out two important considerations: public safety and the voice of the victims of these crimes. I've read the Dash 1. I did not have a chance to vet the Dash 1 with all of the members of the ODAA Legislative Committee or the Executive Board. I will tell you that If one is going to move over the other, the dash one would be much preferable. I think that we could get behind or at least be neutral on the dash one amendment, but we stand firmly opposed to House Bill 2902. I don't have anything else, but I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, and I want to thank you again for giving me this opportunity.
I'm sure you were here, so you heard the testimony.
Yes, sir.
And so you starting out by saying like 25% of the people in Multnomah County are they go under this. They're not registered. They never have to register to begin with.
They start in the alternate disposition.
So I've heard arguments today saying don't register them. You know, you get adjudicated, go through the treatment, and then have the judge decide at the end of that treatment if he or she wants to register or not register the offender. Does that make sense to do that way, and so that not everybody's automatically registered that gets adjudicated to begin with?
Chair Barker, I understand that, and I appreciate it. I'll just point out that there is a reason that there was a two-year waiting period in the law to begin with. And as it was stated a couple of different times, the supervision and treatment regimen that the youth undergo is intense. 3-4 days a week is not an underestimate. It's during that time that, of course, everyone would expect one to be on his or her best behavior. It's in that two-year or more after that intensive level of supervision has ended that there is a risk, and that a court would benefit from knowing how that person has done when not under that supervision. I believe that that's the reason for that 2 years to begin with. I understand not making it automatic at the point of adjudication is appealing, and I can understand that. But I wanted to point out that there is a reason why there was that two-year waiting period.
Thank you. Mr. House, so I think it was Mark who talked about reoffense or sexual reoffense or offense in general between sex offenders, juvenile sex offenders, and juveniles who have committed other crimes. So if the reoffense or the offense rate is the same, then what? Tell me why the registry makes sense. That's not a very clear question at all. But if you've got two populations that offend at the same rate, then why the sex offender registry on one versus the other if they pose the same risk to the community either way?
Well, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, I believe that we're talking about the gravity of the offense is so drastically different, or at least can be so drastically different. Reoffending in a sexual way is so drastically different from stealing again or punching someone again.
Let me make my question clearer. I thought what I heard, and correct me, Mark, if I'm wrong, if you were the one who said it, that for sexual offenses and non-sexual offenses, that the risk to recidivate on a sex offense is the same percentage.
The risk of offending sexually.
Thank you. That's what I mean.
Chair Barker and Vice Chair Williamson, I'm trying to understand the question now, but
do you understand
and
my
I appreciate
Gail?
Ms. Meyer piping up, but it didn't help.
Gail, do you know what I'm talking about? Can you help me clarify what my question is? Because it's super clear to me. And I want to make sure I heard something right.
Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The data showed, presented by Mr. McKechnie, is that if you have youth who committed a sexual offense and youth who committed a non-sexual offense, their risk of offending sexually a second time, for their risk of committing a second crime that's a sexual offense is the same, regardless of whether their first conviction was for a sex crime or a non-sex crime.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm confused. So you're saying non-sex crime. Why don't you just call it property crime then?
Fine. Let's do it.
Well, it
could be assault. It could be burglary. It could be anything.
Okay.
Yeah. So you've got sex offenses and all other offenses. And the risk to Mark, come up.
And we're not trying to ambush you here.
No, either. I'm really trying to understand what we're talking about here. On the reoffense is. and the rate of risk of reoffense on a sex crime.
So would you like me to briefly restate?
Yes,
Mark McKechnie, Youth Rights and Justice again. So a statewide study in Wisconsin compared offenders who had originally been adjudicated of a sex offense with which was 249 offenders with another group of 1,780 offenders who had been adjudicated of a serious non-sex offense. And when they looked at the future offense rates of both populations 5 years down the road, look whether it was arrest or conviction, the rates of committing either a reoffense for the original sex offense group or a first-time sex offense for the non-sex offense group was statistically the same. It was 7% for the group that had committed a previous sex offense and 6% for the group that had not previously committed a sex offense. Therefore, the original offense didn't really predict the likelihood of what they would do in the future.
Thank you, Mr. McKechnie. I appreciate that, and I've had a chance to look at this. I didn't prepare a response for this.
No, right.
I will wing it as best I can. But it goes back, I think, to the original purpose of the Sex Offender Registry, which was a tool for law enforcement to be able to identify potential suspects in a whodunit type of sex offense crime. And I know that there was a testimony about questions put to two Portland Police Bureau members, but in my 20 years, I know that the Sex Offender Registry has helped either solve crimes or eliminate suspects from crimes. And I don't think you can put a price on that when we're talking about a serious crime.
But that's the entire Sex Offender Registry versus adults versus juvenile, which we've
heard. Of course it is.
They're very different populations.
They are, but they also have different rules to either be put on the registry or to get off the registry currently.
Chair Barker, if I could say one thing. The prevalence of predatory stranger sex offense by minors, by youth, is very low. And the times if youth tend to offend against people that they know, youth don't have the ability to be mobile, let alone your predator usually is the person who's walking around in a van or something like that, and they're approaching somebody. But you don't see that conduct very often amongst youth. And so the registry, in terms of helping law enforcement know who offended against somebody when the victim couldn't identify their assailant, does not apply very often to youthful conduct.
And this is for Mark, and he may know this or may not, so I'm just apparently ambushing everybody today. Do you know if there's been any studies done on the number of juvenile sex offenders who are sex offense victims themselves, and if there's any correlation between being offended against and whether or not you had any victim services or treatment and offending as a juvenile?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I don't recall exact numbers off the top of my head, but I recall reading that in the range of roughly a third of adjudicated offenders have been abused themselves. And so, on one hand, that shows it's a significant number. On the other hand, for people who might believe that it was most of them or most all of them, that's not the case. But I think what it goes to is, or helps highlight, is the fact that many of these offenses actually occur within families. And in those circumstances, it's often multi-generational abuse that finally gets discovered. And the last person in the family to be implicated when these offenses come to light is the one who gets prosecuted. And in many cases, it may not be the person who abused that person, who abused that person before them, who was ever prosecuted or caught. And I think that's, important to understand, again, that the nature of many of these offenses, why some of them are dealt with somewhat differently. I would say of the cases where there's some sort of conditional postponement. Often those would be the interfamily cases. But I think part of the problem is that on a statewide basis, each county does things very differently, and our interest in continuing to come back to Salem to make statutory changes is to have some greater consistency from county to county, because we see the cases are dealt with very differently based on local prosecution practices as well as judges' attitudes toward these cases, and having more transparency and consistency in how they're dealt with statewide would be helpful. And first and foremost, making sure that people get access to help, both the offenders and the victims, because again, they cross over, and that the registry doesn't become a barrier to getting the kind of help that these families need.
Thank you.
Nothing further.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll do a little more work on this. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2902 and open a public hearing on House Bill. I'm going to go to the bottom of the list here to 2348. Some people are going to need to leave.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2348 comes to us from the House Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill provides honorably retired law enforcement officers with protections afforded to concealed handgun license holders. The bill, as introduced, has no revenue or fiscal impact. We also have proposed Dash 1 amendments in front of us this afternoon. The amendments would extend those protections to off-duty law enforcement officers as well as those who are honorably retired, and there's no fiscal yet for the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay, Robbie Graves, Mikey EY, and Jack Dempsey. Please go in any order. Remember to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, committee members, my name is Robbie Graves, representing the Oregon Council Peace Officers Association. I appreciate the opportunity given to speak on HB 2348 and the amendment. Currently specified populations are exempt from the prohibitions regarding carrying concealed weapons in public buildings. Those exemptions currently include on-duty police officers, but not off-duty or honorably retired officers. With the amendment, this would clarify that off-duty and honorably retired officers are afforded the same rights to carry concealed weapons in public buildings that individuals with valid concealed carry permits also have. The amendment is required to include both honorary and retired officers, honorary retired officers and off-duty officers. We believe this was the original intent of the bill, and the amendment simply corrects the drafting of that error.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for having me. I'm Mike Ewy with the Oregon State Police Officer Association. I serve in the capacity as a vice president. Here today to support House Bill 2348 with the clarifying Dash 1 amendments. Currently right now is there's some ambiguity with respect to where an off-duty police officer can carry their firearm. We do know that they are exempt in certain locations, but there is a variety of locations where that's still very confusing. So this language would clear that up. Obviously, officers, whether they're on duty or off duty, they're held to a higher code of conduct. So some officers want just to be able to carry their firearm. Others cite personal safety. But bottom line is they're a very good witness of what might happen, as you might recall what happened at the Clackamas Town Center Mall. So I think that is very important for us to fix this loophole and address this and get it corrected. Thank you very much for your time.
Chair Barker, Jack Dempsey, also representing the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I just wanted to clarify on your agenda today. So we are supporting House Bill 2348 with the Dash 1 amendment. Also, the next bill on here, 2357, with the Dash 1 amendment on that, I believe virtually does the same thing that we're trying to achieve in both of these bills. They just go after it in different ways. I didn't sign up on the next one, but we support both concepts with the amendment and would defer to the committee on how you want to proceed with that.
Are there any questions from the committee? And committee, this bill, we had these bills up last session, but because the word gun was in them, there was panic in the building, and so we were not allowed to proceed with it because it said gun. True story. Mitch is looking at me like he doesn't believe it.
No, may I ask you a question?
Sure, yeah.
I got a question, too.
Okay. You want to go first? Okay, you're the dean of the house.
Oh, no, you're the oldest, though.
All right. I'm going to go first. These are situations where a person ordinarily with a carry permit would not be allowed to carry a gun.
No, would be.
Well, if...
Representative Barker, Representative Greenlick, that is correct. If you currently have a CHL permit, you can carry in these places, whereas an off-duty officer cannot, because unless they have that permit, which typically they don't.
Well, why wouldn't an officer have a permit? I guess that's where I was going.
This essentially replaces the need for me to go to the sheriff's office, or Trooper EY would have to go to the sheriff's office to get a concealed handgun permit to carry his gun when he goes to pick up his child at school. It makes no sense. That's what we're trying to fix.
I've been depending on you and Olson to protect me.
I didn't know I'd been violating the law all these years.
You have a national carry?
I don't.
Well, I do.
A lot of enemies.
I would go ahead. Yeah.
So, Representative Krieger.
The HB 218 qualified, how will that affect us?
Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, if you're referring to H.R. 218, the federal concealed carry, I think there's exemptions in that for local jurisdictions. So,
and that bill is a permission. That's not a guaranteed right.
It's not a guarantee. But, this dresses it up for the off-duty, currently active officers. Just clears up that ambiguity, and honorably retired.
Yeah.
Simply because it gives them the same rights as the concealed carry people that we talked about.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that I heard everything correctly. Does the amendment, the Dash 1 amendment, change the purpose of the bill with regard to the retired officers?
It changes the bill with regard to current officers who are off duty.
That's correct.
So we're combining. There's two bills, but what we want to do is say if you are a honorably discharged or honorably retired officer, or if you're currently an officer, this would give you the same right as somebody who has a concealed handgun license.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if the three of you gentlemen have the answer to this question or not. I take slight exception to retired because I did not retire. I'm not retirement age yet, but I used to be a cop. And so I had to go get a CHL, which I did, and they said you need to document your training. So I called DPSST, and they went to the shed, which they called archives, and dug out a ton of paperwork, hundreds of hours of training to do this. Why? I love the bill, by the way. What was the conversation around retired? I'm not talking about fired.
Chair Barker and Representative Springer, my guess is under H.R. 218, and I haven't read it extensively, but my understanding is even though you're not necessarily retired, if you have a certain number of years on in law enforcement, you would still qualify for that retired officer carry under H.R. 218.
That and if you retired on a disability also, I think it's 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not even sure it's that many, but there is some provisions under Oregon law for that.
Mr. Chair, would these officers have ID that indicates their status?
They would. And that would be, and if they didn't, they could show it later as a defense. I mean, if I didn't have it and I had a gun and somebody arrested me, as a defense, I could show it later. But they, you know, as long if I couldn't prove it at the time, they would treat it as though I wasn't, or could treat it as though I wasn't.
To go back to Representative Springer, then maybe the question is to you and both. Then I just want to make sure. So in your case, because you weren't retired, you had to go get a CHL. Would this clean that up?
No.
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 And
does it meet the
May I follow up on that?
Yes.
Let me be clear. I asked that question because I think there's validity in that question. I think it's a very real and good question, part of this conversation. It's not a question that I in any way, shape, or form want to get in the way of the path of this bill. But that said, I think we need to expand the conversation beyond just those that turn 50 and get PERS,
right,
which is a good thing.
Okay, I remember we had somebody on disability who said it eventually, in fact, she was resigning, but eventually mm-hmm. would be able at retirement age, would have qualified. But anything else, anything further? We're not going to move it because we don't have the amendment in. Do we have the amendment ready to go?
We don't have the fiscal.
Okay, no. But we have the actual amendment, though, so we can put it in.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Okamoto, do you want to testify?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2348 and open a work session on House Bill 2348 with the intent of adopting an amendment. The dash ones. 23 at the bottom and 2348.
2348. Okay. We need to hold off on this. We may have a relating to clause problem.
Okay, I will.
So we need to check that out.
Okay, we will not have the work session. We'll continue both, and I'll open and close a public hearing on 2357 so that we have that hanging out there as well. Okay, next item on the agenda is House Bill 2424. Open a public hearing.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2424 comes to us at the request of the Department of Corrections. The bill would authorize employees of the Department of Corrections, State Board of Parole and Probation and Post-Prison Supervision, and Oregon Corrections Enterprises who work at a department building to store a personal handgun and ammunition in their vehicle in a container specifically designed for such use. The bill provides that agencies are not responsible for inspecting or securing such vehicles. There is minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, and the bill as introduced is ready to move.
Okay, thank you. Leonard Williamson and Jack Dempsey, please.
Dempsey just walked out.
Oh. Leonard tells
it. He just walked out the door.
Okay. Jack Dempsey's like, Dempsey. Oh, he's back. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. 2420.
Chair Barker, vice chairs and committee members, my name is Leonard Williamson. I'm the Inspector General for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And we're here on House Bill 2424 in support of that bill. It's an extension of the prior bill, House Bill 4035. What this bill essentially does is expand certain parameters of the former bill and tighten up some of the liability concerns that we expressed last session. So with that, what I would mention is that this bill expands the ability of persons with concealed carry permits that are employees of the Department of Corrections, employees of OCE, Oregon Corrections Enterprises, and the Oregon Parole Board. If they have a concealed carry permit, that they can bring it onto our property, store it in our lockers, or appropriately store it in their motor vehicle, given if they've got an appropriate lockbox. The current language of House Bill 4035 used the word firearm as opposed to handgun, so we're focusing on handguns now as opposed to firearms. Additionally, the prior bill did not address ammunition. So, under prior law, while both handguns and ammunition brought onto corrections property were contraband and subject to felony prosecution, the prior bill didn't address ammunition. So we found ourselves in a place where someone could bring a firearm onto our property but not have any ammunition for it and still be subject to a felony prosecution. This addresses that as well. We are also going to be working on a friendly amendment with our labor partners around the definition of vehicle to include, for example, soft top Jeeps or soft top sports cars. If they have the appropriate lockbox, then we don't have any concern. We would have concern about bicycles. something that could be picked up and moved with the container strapped to it, something like that. The other thing that I want to mention in closing is that we spent roughly $100,000 in terms of purchasing gun lockers. They're now installed at almost all of our facilities. I also want to give a nod to AOCE. They contributed almost $10,000 to that project, and we want to thank our labor partners. They've also been working with us extensively this past year on these amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Jack Dempsey, representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I just want to put our support behind House Bill 2424, and I want to thank the department for all the time we've spent on this since the close of the last session to get to this agreement.
Okay, so, and there is amendment, more amendments coming. Did I hear that right?
There'll be at least one friendly amendment with respect to the definition of a vehicle, and we're working with the Department of Justice around that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anything further? Any questions? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 24.
Thank you.
Before I do that, is there anybody else who wants to testify on the bill? Ms. Botkin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mary Botkin, representing Afternoon Council 75. House Bill 4035 was our bill from last session. There were some holes in it, some errors. This bill fixes those, fills the holes, corrects the errors. And we want to thank the department for working with us to get this done and done in a proper way. And our members, you know, this was a bill that we put in to provide for safe transport from home to work and back again in what can be a dangerous environment. So we appreciate the committee moving this bill quickly, and we appreciate the department's help in getting it done. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Anything further? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2424. Looking forward to the friendly amendment. No further business come before the committee. We stand adjourned. Thank you, committee. No further business come before the committee. We stand adjourned. Thank you, committee.